Welcome to It Can Be Said. My name is Will Calling, and I'm joined as always by the one, the only, Dr. Lou Middup. How are you today, Luke?
I'm very well, thanks. Will, how are you?
I'm good, I'm good. I hear you had five of the best yesterday.
Oh, geez, yeah, Notts County in their continuing quest to try and kill me. We ended up losing the game 5-4.
Now, here's a question, Mr. Simon Alvey. Do you know where the phrase six of the best comes from?
Well, I mean, but then you associate it with it's sort of like corporal punishment and stuff, but I don't know whether it comes from somewhere
But
else.
do you know why it's six of the best?
No, to be fair, I'd never thought about it.
That was legal limit. When they were
Ah.
that there was a point where they were trying to water down corporal punishment, and so it became you could only hit a child six times in one day. So I remember my dad. I remember a guy who used to work for my dad saying that he got in trouble at school once, and he'd been like smacked six times, and he kept on back chatting his teacher because he knew the teacher could no longer do anything to him.
Okay.
Anyway, enough about the type of ragamuffins who my parents employ. We are here. One of us is queer, I suppose. And we're going to talk about politics. Lots and lots of politics. And we're going to start with, oh my God, I've lost one in order already. This is a good start. We're going to start with disability. So guys, I'm going to ask you, Luke, actually, because I thought you were not going to want to talk about this, and you were very keen to talk about it. What did the Department of Work and Pensions do this week?
Yeah, so the Department of Work and Pensions has launched a new publicity campaign to educate the general public on, well, how best to sort of deal with disabled people. And the theme of the campaign is don't assume, ask. That's like the hashtag of the campaign. Now, I think we'll start with the good stuff. I think it's good that the Department of Work and Pensions has put some thought into this. I think there is a place for, any sort of government initiative that tries to make disability and disabled people more visible. And they do seem to have consulted like most of the major sort of charities and sort of third sector organizations before they did this. Which does make the result a little bit worrying and slightly baffling.
Yeah, although not surprising.
Although not surprising. Are you allowed to say that, by the way, Mr. EDI professional?
I will explain my comments when it's my turn.
Okay. I think Lucy Weber did a very good like Twitter thread. Yes. I know it's X, but it will always and forever be Twitter, sod off Elon, on why this is probably well-intentioned, but a little bit stupid, because there's already a tendency for, people to assume that they have the, for people to assume that they have the right as able-bodied people to ask you incredibly intrusive questions, and that you're under some obligation to answer them. And it's like I was trying to think of what the alternative slogan should be.
Well, let's leave that because I think that's when we can kick around ourselves.
Okay.
I suppose I'll explain my kind of snarky comment in the sense of my experience, and this is weird, like like both on both dimensions of it now. Like I have a history of mental illness, not the most extreme history, but I have a history of mental illness. I also do walk with a walking stick now due to issues with my back, but like. I always feel a bit of a fraud to say I'm disabled because it's not the same extent as you guys, other people I know. It's a moderate case of disability. And like, I know this is very, and I've done a work podcast about this. This is very ironic for me as Mr. EDI because I am the person who goes into workplaces to say, the Equality Act says, any physical or mental impairment that is longer lasting than 12 months is a disability. That's what qualifies you for the support. But in the back of my mind, you don't wanna steal valor or claim support that's not really your due. But in my experience from talking to people who are kind of more enmeshed in disability politics, I think one of the issues you have, particularly with all the royal societies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is they tend to get captured by carers, and they tend to get captured by people who are very well-meaning, very passionate, want the best, but there's all no there is a whiff of paternalism about a lot of the disability activism space, particularly sorry, disability advocacy space, particularly the more establishment stuff that the DWP may have more access to, which is why I think when this lands, and it lands on Twitter where there's a lot of disability activists, it kind of went down so badly. So it doesn't surprise me there was this disconnect, because I think this disconnect is kind of riven through disability politics, where unlike the other groups, I think there's a very clear divide between advocacy and activism. What do you think of the whole situation, Simon?
Yeah, I think I've got a lot of time. Mostly I agree, which is obviously very disappointing. But yet again, we're mostly violently agreeing with each other. I think it's worth saying that this is one of those stories that kind of landed, and it did take even me a moment to just go, because I think I saw the same post that Luke did from Lucy Webster of like, oh,
It's Webster is.
I thought it was, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I always think of her as Webber for some reason. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it is Webster.
And it was one of those things I looked at and went, okay. And it was like initially you're like, oh, okay, no, that sounds sensible. And then you kind of, and then you do the double take. And I think that this whole camp of like, oh, no, okay, that's the problem of, like, yeah, you're a bit, there is nothing as sort of frustrating and potentially kind of humiliating as being like asked, the classic question, what's wrong with you, how did it happen, that kind of thing. And I think, and it's those kind of questions, and it's a sort of, and it's a campaign that opens that kind of thing up because it's just quite badly done. And by the way, most of the I the thing this that made me reflect on is my experience of working in an office where, at least visible physical disability is pretty unusual. It's pretty unusual within the sort of image conscious sector, like public relations. My experience of it, my experience of working with colleagues, it's often, a change of line manager. It's a very sort of, it'll be a very quiet, very polite conversation, and they ask the sort of the in inverted commas right questions of like, how can we help? What's, is there anything you need? Is there anything you need? I'm just sort of checking these sort of things out. My former line manager, we've moved offices, and was like, we've got a, we were initially sited in a place with a sort of half dozen stairs, and he was like, is that going to be a problem? Very quietly, very respectfully, it's the you want to ask questions. Sort of, I suppose the point is that the questions you ask should always be should ba it should be about specificity. And about, well, what's the why are you asking this question? And the problem, if you look at the campaign around ask, don't assume, is actually it really is, it's basically an invitation to ask intrusive questions about a thing in your life which you may have a kind of quite a complicated relationship with.
Yeah, and I think this is a thing, isn't it? Like, you should ask questions based on how you should support that person, not to satisfy your own curiosity. Because like, again, like that has happened to me. Like I have had like very well-meaning people, nice people, but like they've asked me, well, what's wrong with you? Why do you have a walking stick? And it's like, well, I don't entirely know. Probably I should go to the GP. Well, I do know why, it's because I'm too fat. But like, though, the actual mechanics of the situation, I just know the walking sticks helps me walk around. But like, you don't kind of need to know that. You just need to know I have this walking stick.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in my own work, one of the things I try and do as much as I can, is to teach myself to be less curious than I am. Because actually, you'll drive yourself mad and you may ask a question you're not meant to ask if you let your mind wander and be more curious than you should be. Just treat thing, no, treat, no, actually, ironically, though, no, you think this would be the opposite of being an EDI officer. But actually, just treat things on a superficial level. You know, if somebody asks you, they need this reasonable adjustment. You know, ask the questions you need to ascertain what they need, what support they need, whether the support is valid, you know, whatever it is. But there's no need to go into more personal stuff. Because yeah, because like, you know, you do, and it's on all things, you do have this thing of people are curious about things that are different to them and they want to find out more, but that can be a burden when placing other people when they're just trying to get on with their day.
Yeah, I mean, recently at the uni, they I so over the summer they put in a load of they put in a load of automatic doors that I asked for, and they finally got me like a I they also put in a rise and fall lectern in one of the lecture theatres again because I asked for it, and I'd been this is stuff I'd been this is stuff. I'd been really sort of reluctant to ask for because I'm sort of, I think this is kind of where me and Simon, even though there's only a few years difference between us, there is, I think, quite a generational gap between somebody in their mid-30s and somebody in their late-30s when it comes to disability because I'm a member of the last generation of disabled people that went to special schools and then transitioned into mainstream education. And I think that actually has left quite a profound scar because I'm always kind of reluctant to ask for adaptions because like I remember like my parents asking for adaptions at school and getting kicked back like constantly and basically sort of oh you know if you can't hack it in mainstream school maybe you ought to go back to special
Yeah,
school.
so very quickly, Luke, because you would have been what, 12, 13 when the Disability Discrimination Act was passed, because that was mid 90s.
No.
Gary 96, it was William Hague who piloted it.
Yeah.
So, like,
I mean,
most of your schooling would have been done without a clear right to adjustments.
yeah. So actually, like, A, because I realized that I'm now settled in St. Andrews and it's not likely that I'm gonna leave. And B, because this new building that they keep promising we're gonna move into seems to be deferred and deferred and deferred. So this summer, I actually finally got around to asking for the stuff I wanted, and it was a really easy process. I'm absolutely kicking myself that I didn't do it years ago. But yeah, it's just, and this is why I think it is important for employers to ask on another in other situations as well, because sometimes it can be quite difficult to have the self-confidence to ask for the things you need.
Well, I know for us at my workplace, what we try to build in is you ask at the point of induction, because for complicated legal reasons, i.e., GDPR, HR law, You declare your kind of demographics at the recruitment stage. That doesn't transfer over. That has to be destroyed. That only can be retained for as long as it's needed to do your recruitment monitoring data. So that's why you're always asked twice your demographics. You can't just say, okay, we've appointed this person, transfer over what they said in Equal Ops form. So like we're trying to get people to ask, because you're right, because like people naturally don't want to say, I mean, I think people should, but
Yeah.
people naturally don't want to say when they go to interview. And there then has to be that conversation about what the job entails and what adjustments need to be made. But yeah, but it can be challenging. Simon,
And I'm
any
sorry. Sorry,
sorry.
can I just finish off there? And I have to say, like, the estates team at St Andrews, my head of school, like my head of school, the school manager, everybody was absolutely fantastic. It's been a really smooth process actually getting all this. It was a lot of doors. It's like my office door, the door leading onto the corridor that my office is on, like three lecture theatres and teaching rooms that I'm gonna use, that I'm kind of now timetabled that I will only use those three rooms. It was a really straightforward process actually.
But this one
The
really.
university handled it really well. And it's not like I haven't had it's not like I haven't had the opportunity to say these things before now. It's just I haven't done it.
And it is worth saying, like, St Andrews is known
Yeah.
for being good at EDI. There was a.
Okay.
Because I think we spoke about it, like, it's won awards, it's got a lot of money. There was a point where there was a job open whilst I was in between jobs
Yes, I remember that
where
now.
you were threatened the possibility of me
Yeah.
being your tenant.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I'd be interested to know is whether St Andrews has a universal reasonable adjustments budget.
I wouldn't know.
Because this is one of the issues I think lots of disabled people face, is that organizations have delegated their reasonable adjustments budget. Sorry, organizations have delegated their equipment budget to the individual teams. So say like marketing or estates or HR or whatever the teams are. They are responsible for paying for the equipment their teams need, even if they're just purchasing it from an internal provider. Like that's the way they track the cost each team is taken up. And obviously, what that means is if you have a big reasonable adjustment, and sometimes, obviously, like I can't imagine what that would have cost, because that's a particularly big one, may even been big enough to get money back off the government. But I have known reasonable adjustments claims go past 10,000. Like it's rare, but it's not uncommon. And that can wipe out a small team's budget. And the danger of that is you create perverse incentives. The manager that doesn't recruit many disabled people, the manager that is bad at signing off on reasonable adjustment requests, they get to spend more of their budget on the stuff that will meet their targets, get them promoted, ensure their customers are happy. And so this is why I know there's a push across this space to move towards universal budgets, because it would use those perverse incentives. The organization as a whole can consume these costs, has to consume these costs. It's a legal requirement, even if individual teams might struggle. Do you have any points on that, Simon? And I'm going to come in with a question about you in terms of your area of expertise.
I have one of those. I think it's really, I actually think that Luke's point is well made about the shift in our lived our sort of lived experience and how it's affected us. But I actually think that it's interesting listening to the way that both as I was listening, sort of listening back to myself and then listening to what Luke was saying about the way, like, very kind of like, oh, very grateful and thankful and like almost surprised that employers are doing the things that, like, I'm gonna be slightly brutal, the things they should be doing. Like, it is, I think there's a huge challenge. It's the kind of culture. It's the culture of, as a disabled person, being kind of grateful that, what they're actually doing by ensuring that the doors are, is actually, they're actually ensuring that one of their, a valued member of their team is able to do their job if complete fully effectively and not, what stressing themselves out about, challenges around, basic things like opening doors. That is a, that's not about, that sort of thing is not about, that's not a kindness with best in the world. That actually is about making sure that you're able to do your job as effectively and efficiently as possible. And I think both of us are in that space. And I, so I think, I think it's, I hope and think that these things are getting better. And hopefully that, people in our shoes who are sort of 10 years younger are a bit more are frankly a bit more demanding of their employers, of their education, of their education institutions, of their living situations, whatever it is that they need that support from. Because, it is these things are to some extent, they are a statutory right. These are, and we are not, talking about this enough. And in terms of sort of getting this back a bit
Oh,
onto,
sorry. Can I just come in directly on that? So I think there's a, several interesting points there. So first of all, one of the interesting things I've always noticed, and again, Luke wouldn't know, but I'd be interested to see how, say, Tangier has handled this because they were so prompt about doing what they did. It normal, so this is a, you can tell which of us has like a, which of us doesn't have a fun, ex well, I think my job is fun and exciting. I actually do, is very creative, but it also involves a bit more managerial guff, as Luke would say. Bump, more managerial bump than Simon and Luke. Normally, with capital expenditure, you account for depreciation. So it's like, okay, we want to do this, but we won't take it out of 1 year's budget. We'll spread it across 5 years' budget. And I've never seen anyone try and do that for a reasonable adjustment. It's always like, well, if you've got to do this reasonable adjustment, this entire piece of equipment purchase, of equipment refinement, of adjustments to the infrastructure, that must be taken out in 1 year's, which is never done for any of a capital expenditure. Secondly, I think the issue will always be like it is, would it, as Luke was saying, it is very reliant on the person asking. Like, I'm in the process of getting a new chair for work, but it's taken me a while to ask for it.
But it kind of has to be, and it's
No, it
not
has
like,
to. No, I'm not blaming my employer. I'm saying like this is saying, like, you have to like reassure people it's okay to ask, but also. No offense, Luke. Like, obviously, like, as we all do, this is the way time works. You are getting older, so part of the issue is that,
Yeah, I was just finding it harder to open doors.
yeah. So, like, and I think that's, like, even for people who, know they're disabled, proud they're disabled, or comfortable being disabled, they may not be comfortable admitting they're getting older, and that, that they are struggling to cope with their disability in the way they once were able.
No, that's a very good point, Will. And actually, the thing that finally sort of persuaded me that I was going to have to ask for this is I changed wheelchairs, and the old wheelchair had steel foot plates, like the actual. The bracket that held the foot plate onto the chair was stainless steel. So if it was a push door, you could just bash it open. The new wheelchair is plastic. So I did that a couple of times and ended up breaking the foot plate. So it's also about how, and this is a thing that I think is with physical disability at any rate. I wouldn't know about any, none of us can really speak to learning or intellectual disability. But yeah, one of the things that isn't talked about enough is the interaction between person and equipment, basically.
Which is actually, which is a side point, which is why I always think the there's a real unexplored intersection between physical disability equality and trans equality, because trans equality has the same intersection between medical advance, the scientific possibilities. Et
Yeah.
cetera, et cetera. Like those, because like certain physical disabilities just stop being disabilities if the science progresses enough. Like, this may not be the first time I mentioned him today, but like Matthew Iglesias made a point that he's short-sighted. No one would think of being short-sighted as a disability in today's world.
Yeah, but like
You.
150 years ago, it really was.
Yeah, so, but because glasses just solved the issue. There's another point I was gonna make to Simon's thing that I've forgotten. What was the last thing you were talking about, Simon?
Just that I think that there's this sort of, just that I think that we're still in a culture where the sense that that things that should just be expected are in fact now still seen as favors.
So here's the thing. Here is the crisis that's coming, is that there are more disabled people about to enter the workforce because there's greater awareness of learning disabilities, of mental health issues, greater openness of talking about them. Also, the workforce is aging. There's going to be this push to keep us working longer into our 60s. There's going to be more people with disabilities in the workforce. And obviously, the statutory requirement is proportionate. So they're called reasonable adjustments because they have to be reasonable. No, a workplace doesn't have to put itself out of business to meet the needs of disabled staff members. So I do worry that the government has gotten a bit too comfortable pushing the costs onto employers for these adjustments and is not kicking enough in to help employers do this. It used to be like Access to Work was a much more generous program. If you work for a medium to large organization, it has to be a pretty big ask, like a pretty big adjustment before Access to Work will kick in money to help the employer do it. And if employers start to get loads of requests, it will hit the point where it's not practical for them to meet all of them. And what happens then?
And
So that's.
I have to say, access to work is probably the difference between me being employed and not being employed, to be honest.
I think this is going to be a real issue as we move forward.
Yeah.
Because like Access to Work can't tell the employer, okay, we've done 20 of your guys. These are
Yeah.
the like the 10 most disabled. Focus on these guys. Don't forget about the other 10. The employer will be left to make whatever decision they want to make, and based on what most employers do, it'll probably be the wrong one. So I think there is, I don't know when, but there is a storm coming in terms of this, in terms of.
I think that's a really interesting point. Well, like I say, access to work has been an absolute godsend to me. It's like one of the DWP's programs that actually up until now has been really effective. So
When was your last assessment?
When I changed contracts at St Andrews, so about 6 years ago.
Yeah, that'd be why. That'd be why.
Okay. So basically, what you're telling me is I shouldn't go for promotion.
Well, no, like, as long as your workplace is happy to accept the
Yeah.
old report, there's no reason they have to get you to change
Okay.
the data. The only if your needs change do they need to update it.
Okay.
I think, unless you've got money on the line, in that case it may change. But you know, so Simon, as a professional, as a quote unquote PR professional,
Yes.
how much empathy did you have when you saw this campaign being ripped to shreds online?
Not a lot. I get like this is fine. I don't think anyone works that I work with is this fine. I get sick and tired of comms agencies, and I can't speak for marketing agencies. I've never worked in one, but I'd be amazed if it was massively different. They don't deal with disabled people very well and or very often. Like with the best one in the world, a lot of the time you're talking to people and like they just don't like I'm often the first disabled person they've ever like worked with. It's an industry that doesn't have disabled people in it because it's an image obsessed industry. And it means that these sort of things are missed. I remember very vividly working on a campaign. I was working on a campaign around increasing access to. It was something to do with sport and exercise and broadening it out. I don't think it went anywhere, and I'm not going to name the client. But I sat there in the presentation from the creatives and watched as throughout this process, I saw the words the disabled, not disabled people, not people with disabilities, but like the disabled. So again, just not in any way thinking about them as human beings. And it was actually kind of upsetting. I was in a meeting literally this week where I saw, like, you know, again, it was a campaign and there were a variety of groups with, a variety of sort of different minority groups where the term differently abled was used. And like both
Oh
of these,
God, I
exactly
haven't heard
right.
that in years.
Well, exactly. This is my point. It's like, and these are not, I've got to make it very clear. In neither of those cases do I think that those colleagues are either idiots or, certainly not vindictive people or not people who wanted to go out there and do anything particularly, they weren't trying to be actively unpleasant. I don't think in either case, by the way, when they were presenting that, they realized they were presenting to someone who has, experience of disability. There, that's a, my point is that I don't have a huge amount of sympathy because I know this industry. I know that this industry just has a complete blind spot with the best one in the world. Like, we're not brilliant on. I feel bad because like I'm being mean about an industry that I've worked in for a long time and I know very many good people and many people who respect and like me and but there are problems. Like we know that there are not enough people from ethnic minority backgrounds. We know that there are not enough people from caste backgrounds that aren't pretty posh. I mean, it's an office where I feel I can do the four Yorkshireman sketch, and I am as the most solidly upper middle. Like I come from a solidly upper middle class background. My father earns, significantly more than the national average. And that's not all boasting. I'm just saying that's, I come from a very middle class, very smart area of the world. Went to a very good comprehensive school, and I feel like I can, go well. I went to a school my parents didn't pay for, it's a huge problem in the industry, and it's moments like this that reveal like why it's not just bad in terms of are we opening up opportunities to people that, could be really good at it and deserve a chance. If you'd had a disabled person on that campaign, right? And as I say, I didn't spot it immediately, but you know, if you were working on this, you would spot it. They didn't. I can tell you that. I could put.
Or to be honest, Simon, even if you hadn't have spotted it, at least it's have a fall guy. Like
Well,
we no, in terms of the
yeah, we checked
organization
this.
protection, we checked with a disabled person. They said it was okay. Why are you complaining? The fact that that statement hasn't came out
Yeah.
makes me think that didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. I mean, it didn't happen, and it may have been. I can fully imagine that, you know, there was someone who, you know, who had a niece that had a disability, or because there is that, like, it is the point you make about like carers having too much of a role. Like, they have a role, but they have a space in being listened to, but it is different. And like, I just watched that kind of campaign, and I mean, slight head in my hands, but yeah, no, no sympathy. I mean,
Well,
absolutely, like, it is in.
I didn't say so. I didn't expect you to have sympathy. I said empathy.
No, not particularly. No, because
No.
again, because of my, as I
No,
say,
because
it's
I
a
didn't.
problem across, it's a problem industry wide, and I've seen the effect of it. I've seen the effect of it in first hand.
No,
And
like,
I can see how this happened.
I'm just an interesting question, Simon. Do you think the fact that the PR industry is so centered in London contributes to poor disability access? Because I don't know, and like, as you know, as my back has gone worse, like I try and steer clear of London more than I used to because it is difficult to get around. If no, it's a lot more of a commute. You can't rely as much on taxis as you can elsewhere.
Well, all I would say is that having lived in London as a disabled person for a terrifyingly long time at this point, it's the one city in comparison. It's true, it's a lot bigger, but it is one of the few cities in the UK with a genuinely proper integrated transport
That's
system.
true.
So actually, if you know, if I because I do occasionally, right? I'm in my mid-30s. I'm getting tired and I'm getting old. I am, you know, and I am sort of looking wistfully at cities other than London because it's an exhausting, expensive city. And, you know, you kind of think, and the cities I look at as potential places I could live aren't that many because there aren't that many with proper integrated transport systems. It's probably realistically London, Newcastle, Manchester, Edinburgh, Glasgow.
Yeah,
You know, cities that I could sort of because, and I like it's obviously different for different forms of disability because I'm aware that. For a wheelchair user, the tube is a lot more challenging to use than for me, who is someone whose disability doesn't require me to use a wheelchair. But I don't think that's the focus, the centering of industries like media,
Oh, sorry,
communications, and
Tommy, if I can
advertising.
just come back on that. Because one thing I think you're overlooking, not that I'm encouraging you to come and move to Birmingham, is, but like I am, it'd be great. Is like I can get a half an hour taxi for 13 quid.
Yeah, no, I understand
Like the
that, and
public transport's bad, but like taxis are cheaper, which to a certain extent even things out, unless you're a wheelchair user, obviously.
yeah, I mean, no, I do get that. I think it's just about, for me, the joy of a public transport system like London's, where, you
Oh,
know,
yes.
it's the joke of London, being a Londoner is you're like, I've got to wait 7 minutes for a train. This is appalling behavior. And it's true. It that does that you what we are lucky. We are privileged enough that that does happen. Is just the independence of not having to rely on a cab driver and think about it in that way. But I think it's less an issue with this, but it's absolutely an issue for, well, certainly a class problem, because if you have, London is famously a very expensive place to live. And unless you have either independent wealth, which is going to be your parents at the start of your career, or parents who happen to live, people, family who happen to live probably in Greater London or maybe the Home Counties, you know. Starting your career in an industry like that is really hard, you know, it's really difficult. And, you know, this is a different argument, but it is certainly true that, for industries that are focused in London, it becomes a you end up with one perspective on things, because like it's not that you couldn't end up with, working class voices that way. You couldn't end up with voices from different ethnic backgrounds, but they might all be working class or BME Londoners. And those are completely valid perspectives, but they are not the only perspective on any one issue. And you want, when you're dealing with communications, when you're dealing with how do we talk to people, yeah, actually, like, and how do you market to people, being able to getting people who've got wider range of perspectives is really, really important. I really feel like I'm just at work now.
Sorry. Well,
No, it's fine.
I will continue this by building on that and continuing to be in work myself. In the sense of one, but listen to you, one of the things I became, I think I'm in a process of being slightly radicalized on, is starting to believe in positive discrimination, even though I don't think you can actually ever do it, because I don't think there's a constituency necessary to support it. So, to give people the lay of the land, in Britain, you can do positive action, which are measures to try and level the playing field. So, targeted promotion, targeted training, targeted support. If candidates are tied, you can give additional consideration for candidates from a disadvantaged background. You can also do like genuinely occupational requirements where like there's a the job has a particular need. That particular job has a particular need for somebody from a certain background. What you can't do, which used to be the case in America, less so now, after several Supreme Court judgments, is say, well, no, what we're trying to do is in this educational setting, in this workplace setting, we want to ensure it's got a diverse range of people. And so we will actually recruit to maintain diversity. That's illegal. And there's a lot of case study about this where the Equality Act works. No white people can bring cases against the courts as much as anybody else for race discrimination. And no one works independently. We are all part of a team, and teams are stronger if they are diverse. So, no, it would obviously be absurd to say every person in that meeting you're in, Simon, should be disabled so that they can understand the disabled perspective. But that meeting was strengthened by having at least one person in that room who was disabled. And like you can take it too far because, people, not every person wants to kind of bring their lived experience to work. I think there has to be some way of actually allowing employers to say, we have four identical jobs. We want these four identical jobs because they're all going to be working together to be done by different people, by different types of people, because we actually want these four identical jobs to be hitting different communities. And like this is what everyone does in more informal lines of work. Technically, it's illegal, and it's definitely illegal when you apply it to full on employment. But the reason why it's not possible is because actually, Not only would, rightly so, with the basis of the law, people who are denied the opportunity to get a job complain. In my experience, the people who are going for the jobs don't want to get that boost either. No one
No.
wants to hear they got that job because of something to do with their demographics. And at work, I did the analysis, and I was part of these people actually. I was one of these case studies. The disability is unique in a protected characteristics where protected the positive discrimination is allowed because the government was really wedded to the two ticks scheme, which is now disability confident. And two ticks is positive discrimination, so it allows the possibility that, so for those that know, two ticks is, well, it's not called two ticks now, but like two ticks is that if you say you're disabled and you say you want to be part of the guaranteed interview scheme, if you meet the essential criteria, you get an interview. And if you say you got 20 candidates for interview, five spots to be interviewed, so 20 in the shortlist, five to be interviewed, you could be 12th and you would get an interview because you met the essential criteria. Now, you're not going to get the job if you're that far down on the shortlist because you're just not qualified for the job. There are better candidates, but they can't say no. And of course, what it means is disabled people who, will usually find it more challenging to get to interviews, get called to a load of meaningless interviews for jobs they're never going to get. And it's
Yeah,
just.
that, I mean, I can speak from personal experience. Before I came to St Andrews, that happened to me on probably half a dozen occasions. There was one interview in particular that I went for and did the two ticks thing, and the you know I gave the presentation, and the presentation itself actually went really well. But then you get to the question and answer bit, and it's like, I'm qualified for this job just about, but I've clearly not got quite the research and teaching profile you were looking for. And this particular job was in Aberdeen. So I'd got literally the whole length of the country, more or less like half the length of the country, to go for a job that in reality I had no chance of getting. And that's why actually I stopped doing the two I at that point I actually stopped doing the two ticks thing,
Well,
because it was a waste of time.
this is a point I was going to make, which is I did the analysis and we recruited more disabled people who hadn't ticked, done the second tick than who had done the second tick. Because obviously, all the disabled people, and I include myself on this, and like, not so much on my own experience. I think I just listened to you. All the disabled people who had been round the block were like, no, fuck that for a game of monkeys. If you think I'm good enough, you can interview
Yeah,
me.
and
If
I mean
not,
that
no.
because I mean that's the thing. I always thought that the two ticks thing, the way they should have made it work is in the reply email or in like the invitation to interview, they should have had to state whether they were giving me the interview because I'd done the two ticks thing. Because if they'd done that, I would have said thank you, but
That's an
thank you, but no
interesting,
thank you.
and they could have. No, I'd go a bit further with that. That's a really interesting idea, because what they could do, they could tell you your rank in shortlisting.
Yeah.
Because like, if you were like seventh out of five, if that makes any sense. So you were a
Yeah.
couple off. You were like Oh, you know what? I'll change my arm at that. Like maybe I can impress them enough to get the job. Whereas if you're 15th out of five, it's like, okay,
Yeah, forget it.
I'm not going. You know I might have to, because the thing is, like, if the nice HR man had have called you and said, look, Dr. Medup, I know we've got to give you this interview, but you ain't gonna get this job. Don't
Yeah.
come.
Yeah.
That'd been a very nice thing for him to do, particularly because it got you about £30,000 when you took him to an industrial tribunal. But I wonder if you legally could do that as a. I might have to ask HR. Is that? What do you think, Simon? Because that would be a that if you could know where you came, like that seems to be a way of letting people benchmark whether it's worth going for.
Oh yeah, I told. I don't know. Firstly, it's been a while since I've had a sort of proper, job interview in a business that doesn't know me kind of thing. But I've never really understood the guaranteed interview scheme anyway. Maybe this is probably privilege if I have a certain set of disabilities that mean that I don't, I think I'm in.
I think it's more endemic in the public sector because it's a government thing. If you want to get the DWP's Disability Confident Employer, you have to do it.
But no, but I mean, fine, whatever. I've never fully understood why, what the rationale is, but maybe I'm an idiot,
No,
so.
no, no, no. So the rationale is that employers would discriminate against disabled people. So if a disabled person meets the essential criteria, you have to give them an interview. It's like it's a really this one's like, it predates the wider infrastructure of the Equality Act, and they had to do a carve out to keep it going because it was such a kind of a emblematic. Like this was the thing you did for disability inclusion in the workplace, but like I don't think it's a particularly good thing. Blunt.
It's a very blunt instrument.
I always feel like it's designed to get a disabled person a job on a supermarket checkout. Or in a woodwork, like it's designed so an employer trying to get people for quite low banded jobs doesn't automatically dismiss the idea a disabled person can do it. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe for those jobs, it's really effective.
I think it probably does have a place. I think it probably does have a place for that reason. But yeah, it cost me a lot of time and money. For it cost me a lot of time and money for not much, for no gain. Essentially.
Maybe you could do it as a, and this is me being crazy. Maybe you do it as a free text, and somebody can tick whether they want to know where they came in the shortlisting. But anyway, that was a bit of a sidebar, but a very interesting one. Okay, before we move on from this topic, I will add, I did have a bit of empathy for them. Because I have done campaigns like this and I can see what they were trying to say. And I really could. And it is very much that, listen to disabled person, work out what their, no, don't guess what their needs are. Let them tell you what their needs are, work with them. To agree the adjustments, and it just came out wrong. And I've done two videos where they've had that as a has a message within them. So like, no, Luke mentioned this earlier. No, what would be our, no, what would be our suggestions to them in terms of their slogan? Luke, you had one ready to go.
I think it should be, is there anything I need to know?
When you said that to me, I suggested changing it to, is there anything you need me to know?
Yeah.
So it's the emphasis on what the disabled person needs the other person to know. What about you, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, is there anything we need to know? It feels a little bit legalistic, and it doesn't, to me, the best sort of comms and marketing campaigns sort of ring do that thing of ringing with, because I was about to go, how can I help? But then that becomes kind of like, you know, pushing chairs without people. But I suppose how can I help is quite nice.
So the one I had was check then help.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, it's hard. It's hard though. This is actually, maybe I do have slightly more empathy when we're actually sitting here and going, here's what.
Yeah, no, because because I've gone through these type of campaigns before,
Yeah.
it is because like actually you saw the snip the video I did a few years ago, and you didn't like it, did you? No,
I
Luke.
oh right, as I say, I you know.
Oh, sorry, I was like pointing to Luke. I always did, for some reason I always think it is you to my left, and Luke to the
I
right, and
wonder
I was pointing to
how
Luke.
that possibly could have come around about. Yeah, so it
Yeah,
was like, so it's you literally point for hither and thither.
and I pointed like, how can you not see who I'm pointing to, Simon? Oh yeah, that's why.
And no, I didn't. No, I don't think there was anything that you did particularly well, but I didn't like that video because it did feel, I don't know, it felt a little bit, what's the word? It felt a little bit in, I don't know what it was. It didn't fit because it was like a video of like an interaction. It was like, how are you supposed to do it? It didn't feel like a normal human conversation
Okay.
somehow.
Well,
Yeah.
that's just cause we were told we had 3 minutes, but
It
I tell you what, that was really, no, when we showed that to people, that video was really controversial. Like, so to that, for those who don't know, including Simon, I did I got government funding back in 2018 for a microaggressions video, and we'd all different microaggressions. And one of them was ableism. And the example we got from our staff network was about, you know, a wheelchair user, like someone grabs the wheelchair to steer the wheelchair. And like, you know, the wheelchair user, you know, who has upper body mobility was like, no. I'll tell you if I need help. You know, type thing. And that was really controversial when we showed that to audiences because you would have people say, and particularly EDI audiences actually, like, or EDI practitioners, because they would say that the person's just trying to help. Why can't they help? When I said, well, they didn't ask, you know.
Yeah, it's.
Oh, carry on, Simon.
I wonder then if, because actually, your line may actually not be a bad slogan for this alternative campaign, of something like, "I'll let you know,"
Yeah, ah, yeah, that'd work.
which is like, which is putting the, because it's about putting the power into the hat. It's about kind of. Because what you're trying to stop is people going, you know, how did you get like that? And I'll let you know is because that's actually that's my I can't speak to I'm incredibly open about a lot of aspects of my disability. I'm incredibly you know my standard joke is you know I was able to buy a flat. Why? Because I'm you know because medical negligence. Like I am very open about well because it's true. And like it's. But I'm very open about that. I tell a lot of colleagues that, and there are lots of elements of my disability that I'm really symbiotic. There are things about my disability you guys don't know about, and I'm not going to discuss here. And there are things that, you know, that it's only my close friends and my family and my partner who know about them. But like, there are. But I'll let
Wait,
you know
wait a
if.
minute. Wait a minute. Did Simon just say we're not his close friends?
No, I think
No,
it's being recorded and put
that.
out into the world. No, I am. No, I'm not.
Yeah.
No, I'm absolutely not. I'm saying there are things that there are things. There are things about my disability that I can name the number of people who know about them are, you
Yeah.
know, a few
Yeah.
medical professionals and a few people in my life that need to know that. And there are other things about my disability that a lot of people know about, and a lot of my, you know, and there are things that only my close friends, of which obviously I include you two, know about. But I'll let you know. So
I'm
to
saying
me,
it. I'm in fragile state. You both did enough of my Roman Empire joke, and now this, you know, like.
I didn't laugh at the Roman Empire joke, but that Donald Duck AI thing you shared with me will haunt my dreams for weeks.
yeah. Anyway, sorry, Simon. Carry on.
But because that, I think, is how. Certainly, my experience of disability is it's a gradual process. You know, you don't come into a, you know, new social setting or a new environment or whatever and kind of set, tell them everything about your life and as you would with a close friend.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, if you're in a, I don't know, if you're in a in a space that's not going to be accessible, I mean, in your case, you know, if it's somewhere that you know need that had stairs or whatever, you know, or,
Yeah.
you know, you go, oh, actually, that's not that's
Yeah.
going to be an issue. I'll let you know if that's gonna. I'll let you know as and when you. Yeah, it's on a
Yeah.
need to know basis,
No,
essentially.
you know, I sorry, I want to come directly back on that now. I know you're in. I like that. I'm gonna steal it for work.
That's fair.
Because I think I can see how you do this, and I think you know what I think this is. They were producing posters, right?
Yeah.
They weren't thinking of the poster. They were thinking of the Twitter hashtag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'll let you know, doesn't really make sense as a Twitter hashtag. It absolutely makes sense as a poster slogan.
Yeah, like, you
You can
know.
have the question at the top, you know, do you need help with that? Can you get down the stairs? Can you open that
Yeah.
door? Now, whatever it may be, I'll let you know. Like, that absolutely works and be a really striking poster. It doesn't necessarily, and maybe it would work as a hashtag, but I it wouldn't, it's not something you'd naturally do as a Twitter hashtag. So I think it is one of these things where once again the government has confused Twitter with real life. Luke.
Just to build off of what Simon said, and this is one of my favorite stories. My third year of university, we're all getting ready to go to. I think we got some spare tickets to a law ball or something. But anyway,
I don't know why you're
really,
asking me, Luke. I didn't come until your fourth year.
anyway. Really form really formal occasion. So it's me and our friend my it's me, our friend Miles Nestor Harwood, our friend Steve Harwood, and a bunch of other friends of mine who are lawyers who you guys don't know who, or, well, I say they're lawyers, they were doing law degrees. Some of them are lawyers now, some of them aren't. And like this fleet of cabs. This fleet of cabs turns up that Steve has ordered, and not one of them's got a ramp. And Miles turns to her and goes, "You don't." Miles turns to her and goes, "You don't see what you've done, do And Steve goes, well, I've got lots of friends who are third year. I've got lots of friends who are third year.
I've heard that story before. It's adorable.
I love that about Steve because it was absolutely no, Miles said you don't realise what you forgot, do you? I love that line with Steve because he was absolutely sincere as well. It was absolutely sincere.
What was it like? Do you remember, like, because obviously Luke, for those who know, Luke has like a electric wheelchair, and this again comes back to people get old.
No. I missed it. Don't you? Miles said to Steve, "You don't you really don't see why Luke's different." And she goes, "I've got a lot of friends who are 30 years." I love that. That's when I knew me and Steve would be friends forever. I love that. I love that story.
No, that's a
I've
really
got lots of friends who are 30. Sorry.
it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because
Yeah.
it comes back to the do you see color kind of arguments.
Yeah.
And I've always had sympathy for both sides
Yeah.
in the sense of I understand what I understand the steel man case of both, and I agree with both. I also understand the straw man case of both, like argument against, and agree with that too, in the sense of ideally, you know, if your friends, if your co-workers, you know, whatever it might be, differences should dissolve and you interact as equals. And so, like, oh, you know, this person is in a wheelchair or different color to me, or if they're in religious garment I don't wear, you know, whatever it may be. Like that should all dissolve and we just relate as equals. But obviously, that can easily flip over to I forget to make adjustments to
Yeah.
make accommodations for the fact they are different and I stop caring about that stuff. And so it's a real.
I mean,
There's
what?
the thin line, and I agree with you. Like I think Steve threads it well, but like there's a thin line that like we are all walking in the
Yeah, I
valley
mean.
of the valley of equality, with two cliffs of inequality either side of the valley.
Yeah, but I mean that was the thing. The reason why I wasn't offended in that moment was Steve's absolute sincerity when she said, "I've got lots of friends who are 30 years." It wasn't that she'd forgotten and was trying to like recover the position. It was that she was genuinely baffled as to what she was supposed to have done. Oh, my heart melted. It absolutely melted.
So, so, so.
I will carry that as a very happy memory till the day I die.
So, so moving on from talking about equality to talking about equality. So, Mrs. Braverman went to New York. Not quite the movie. So what it takes Manhattan. Is
Yes.
what I should have gone with.
Yeah.
We started with Luke last time. So Simon, what did our illustrious Home Secretary tell the UN?
Well, she sort of told the UN that one of the key its key sort of achievements as an organization was bad and wrong and unacceptable, which is essentially that there needs to be a fundamental rewriting of what counts as a refugee. The one that she sort of used as her sort of exemplar in general terms was that just because you're gay doesn't mean that you need to be regarded as a refugee, which in if we consider that there are still quite a few countries in the world where being homosexual is an act that can be punished, not an act, sorry, is a characteristic that can be punished by a death penalty. And like seems unreasonable. I and she's and so what th this is an attempt to overturn all of the reasons for refugees. Now, my understanding is one of the main reasons. So this refugees convention is, I think, from the early 1950s.
Do you want me to explain this, actually, Simon? Because this is a part of the speech I agree with, but in a way she means. So I can explain this because it cuts against like a key Tory right talking point. So there's a 1951 UN Convention on Refugees. There's also a 67 protocol. That was like added to it. Bizarrely, the US signed up to both, but only ratified the protocol because the Republican Senate in 51 wouldn't ratify the convention. So, like, everyone pretends the Americans have signed up to both. Maybe they haven't. Who knows? But like, this is like, and like when I heard she was making a speech, I thought it was, oh, this is actually quite interesting because this has been my talking point against the idea that leaving the European Convention of Human Rights would actually do anything. Because, no, this is basically what sets up the current paradigm of if you are under persecution, whether from the state or from non-state actors, due to an aspect about yourself, including political belief, you can claim asylum in a country whose territory you are on. And so what that does is it privileges people who can get to a safe country. So, no, if you want to claim asylum, you have to get to a safe country. Once you get to that safe country, they have to consider whether your asylum claim is reasonable. Like, I'll hand back to you so you can talk more about your reaction to it. But, like, that is what she was arguing against, which often gets blamed on the European Convention of Human Rights. But it's not. The European Convention of Human Rights is just like codifying how Europe interprets that responsibility. But that's why America has Remain in Mexico policies now, so people can be processed in Mexico. Because the minute people get into America, then they have to be that their asylum pro they can't they can't deport people back to an unsafe country. This is a part I forgot to mention. The issue you have is once people get there, you can say no, but if you still think their country's unsafe, you can't deport them back. That's the bind countries are getting into. This is why America has Remain in Mexico policies. This is why Australia invests so much in stopping people getting to its shores and sends people back to up to nearby islands because they want to stop these UN rights kicking in. So actually, no one's picked up on it, but they should have been if she was making a serious speech, which she wasn't. There should have been a real push against the let's leave the European Convention of Human Rights.
I think that's really interesting. So, but it is about deconstructing the human, the sort of that human rights agenda, because essentially one of the reasons, the great human rights the great moment from which, not the, sorry, great moment, it's obviously one of the worst moments in human history, but the moment that sort of defines so much of this is, of course, attempting to go, we must never have the Holocaust happen again. And a lot of that was a sense that, governments were able themselves to make the decision as what counted as, a threat to human life and such in that way. And that's the sort of thing that and Braverman is sort of argue. I think you're right. It was not a speech befitting a British Home Secretary of any sense. It was a dog whistle piece of, it's the speech that she was giving as the first round of what is going to be an interminable Conservative leadership election, which, if it's starting in September 2023, and it's distinctly possible we've got another year left of this government before we're even going to get into a Conservative leadership election, it's going to be absolutely horrible. But it is, there is, I think, we do need, this is about a government that has failed to come up with any serious answers on what they're going to do around small boats and about asylum. And they've not tried to make any kind of genuine case. And they've not tried to have any kind of, I mean, they are trying to get some international agreements, so they're largely asked. And so their answer is to flail around. And the problem is that if the British government, does want to try and have a serious international, you don't go to the UN and make a speech that tags you as a crazy, as a sort of, tags you as a load, as a sort of person of who's made this map, this ludicrous idea. All it's going to do is they're going to go, oh, well, British Home Secretary isn't a serious player. We're not going to worry about her anymore.
I mean, and I think this is where, like, I kind of see this slightly differently because I think the crazy ideas are elsewhere, and the crazy stuff in the speech is elsewhere. The fact that the convention and protocol have to be revisited, is not just sensible, it's a statement of the bleeding obvious, in the sense of these conventions, so this convention and its protocol were written when you could rely on transport logistics to limit the amount of people who would take Western governments upon the offer. Like in a sense of everybody can come if they can get here is a very different thing to say when it was difficult to get here. And that's before you get into the thing of actually one of the reasons that this was said was not the Holocaust, it was great power co competition with the Second World, where we knew the Second World was desperate to not lose manpower, because manpower is important in an era of heavy industry, in an era where man-on-man combat would have been important in the conventional war. As we moved away from heavy industry, as we seem to have moved away even for poorer countries, from where man-on-man combat is preeminent, that is less of a consideration. Actually, it helps dictatorships is if people who are unsatisfied leave. I think we also have, which is becoming a growing issue, and I've seen it in Canada recently, is what restrictions, safe havens, should be required or can require refugees abide by if they are being hosted by a country friendly to the country they've left, because increasingly countries aren't willing to let somebody sit in Canada, sit in England, sit in America, and still be active participants in their domestic country's politics if they're refugees. So, like, I think there's all sorts of issues that actually need to be addressed. And I don't know the answers, but like the current system is not working. No one thinks it's working. And it is a system that has been set up by these UN treaties, Luke.
You know what? You know what this is. You know what this has made me think of, and it doesn't. Admittedly, it doesn't take much to. It doesn't take much to take me back to the early 2000s and the war on terror, because, it's kind of mentally where I live a lot of the time. It reminds me of the torture memos just after 9/11. So they're written by a whole group of lawyers, but the lawyer who has a signature on them is a guy called Jay Bybee. And they do a really interesting analysis of all the ways in which the prevalence of non-state actors on a battlefield makes the Geneva Convention, and the word Bybee uses is quaint. And what you're when the point you're making, Will, is that modern conditions render a lot of these conventions quaint.
Oh, way to throw me into the bus, Luke.
Well, that was kind of what you
Well, yeah,
were saying,
but
Will.
like things have actually changed, whether it's right to torture people hasn't.
No, well. No, they won't say that. They would say that the Taliban doesn't deserve the Taliban and Al Qaeda don't deserve the protections of the Geneva Convention, because the Geneva Convention wasn't drawn up with those kind of groups in mind, which is kind of what you were saying. Anyway, my point is, but what follows from that, or what should have followed from that, was the Bush administration at a moment of like maximum international sympathy. Should have sat down, should have, sent people to Geneva and said, "Look, world, let's sit down and hammer out a new series of rules here." Instead, what it did is the existing rules don't meet the moment, therefore, there are no rules. Therefore, we could do whatever we want. And that kind of seems to be Braverman's logic as well. I kind of agree with you, Will. I can follow her up to the point where she says, these conventions aren't fit for purpose anymore. But the reaction to that shouldn't be we just ignore them. The reaction to that should be actually there is an emerging global consensus. Because you talked about the United States, you talked about Australia, Germany has just reintroduced border checks to deal with this urgent migration. There is, enormous pressure on the likes of Italy and Greece, with completely unsustainable numbers of people trying to enter those countries. So, if Suella Braverman was serious, the second half of that speech should have been a roadmap to, we need a new set of conventions, not just we're going to pull out of the old ones.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely in the sense of you would needed to have like what you are looking for fundamentally is we will no longer privilege people who get to our shores illegally. They just get deported back to their country of origin
Yeah.
and get to fend for themselves. Actually, we have safe points dotted around the world that people should go to.
You talked about this with me offline. I mean, in theory, it works, but in practice, where would those safe points be? Which them?
This is where
Yeah.
you throw up your hands and say, like, this is where
Yeah.
you need to kind of, but that like the alternative of people go to the safe countries. Because let's face it, by safe countries, we mean North America, we mean the EU, we mean Japan, maybe Japan. Like we mean, and obviously Australia, New Zealand. We mean the West. So like we're saying, like in terms of the West kind of taking refugees, there has to be points you go to claim, or there's a process you claim, and then you can go. Like it has to be a way you can access, you can request asylum, have your claim accepted, be matched with a country, and then get there. And I genuinely I can think of ways, but I generally don't know what's the right way. But that is your, it is a more, it is actually more internationalism. Because at the moment we are in beggar thy neighbor.
Yeah,
Because what
and
it seems.
I mean th this would have to be this would have to be kind of a blue helmeted UN
Yes.
initiative. So so actually it would be like the UNHCR runs these safe havens. The UNHCR mandates certain numbers of people to go to certain con to go to certain countries.
Yeah, like if you're in these countries, you want asylum, you go here.
Yes,
Type thing.
but the only thing is, I don't think you can clearly identify where here is.
Well, this is why it has to be a UN process, right? Like,
Yeah.
you'd have to carve it out. Like you'd probably end up like almost like mini Vatican states ran by Vatican cities run by the UN. Likewise, it probably no, it would require, I think, more active kind of countries must work to get rid of refugee settlements, because I think there has been a normalization that countries just allow refugee settlements to kind of exist on their borders, but actually it's like, so it's like Syria. There are still huge refugee settlements
Yeah.
next to Syria, but the Syrian war is basically over. So like,
Well, no, not really.
well,
No.
we know who's going to
No.
win.
Yes, but that's a long way from saying it's
Well,
over.
put it this way, like someone should be cracking heads to get the war over more quickly, because this is the thing as well, like it's the push factors as well. Like, why are the Americans still not giving the Taliban Afghanistan's money? Like, all they're doing is starving people and contributing to the migration crisis that
Well, I mean
radicalizing European politics.
the issue with that that's even more knuckleheaded is UN sanction is US sanctions against Venezuela. Which
Yes.
is dro which is driving a huge refugee flow and achieving exactly nothing in terms of like bringing about a
Yeah,
restoration of democracy in Venezuela.
but is that knuckleheaded or is that good? Because, the guy who put that in is a Republican senator, and the fact that immigrants are coming to America helps the Republicans because they can fearmonger against it.
Yeah.
And if those people come and they get citizenship, they'll probably end up voting Republican because
I
they
mean
hate socialism.
the we're getting kind of off the point here, but the issue with the Taliban is I frankly wouldn't lift I understand what you're saying about the hardship that's causing, but I wouldn't lift those sanctions because there is more than circumstantial evidence that Al-Qaeda and other international terrorist groups are re-establishing themselves in Afghanistan, and they're doing it
Well, in
with
that
the
case,
Taliban.
give us
And
something kind.
and like I said, they're doing it with the Taliban's connivance.
Well, give it to me.
So
Give it to me in kind, then.
you, I
Say.
think I think there's a I think there's a I think there's a serious point about either releasing it in kind or releasing it directly to the remaining aid agencies that are still working in Afghanistan.
Any thoughts on that, Simon?
No, not nothing in particular, to be honest.
But let the hit now, here's the thing, right? You know what we've all done? We've just had a very serious conversation about ideas. And we're gonna have about it in a second. This is not what Sverda Braverman did.
Yeah.
So we should remember that when we come to the end of this conversation, because and talk about the speech she actually made. Because the other thing she kind of waved about in passing was the idea of multiculturalism and how it's failed. So I'm going to go to you again, Simon, because me and Luke were talking for a while as we nerded out about foreign policy and immigration restrictionism. So Simon, can you explain this multiculturalism that Britain, America, and France are all following at the same time?
Oh, it's just, it's very, very strange. Yeah, there are three very different models, that these countries have gone with that.
Oh, sorry, Simon. She included Belgium as well, like Belgium.
I mean, it's just, again, I'm sorry. I understand, like, I find it. Sorry, I'm being like, I don't really get. I know that, and you make the entirely fair point that the people who come from, immigrant backgrounds are allowed to be anti-immigration, but I find it very baffling that somebody who claims themselves religiously to be a Buddhist is sitting around a cabinet table led by a practicing Hindu, with Muslims in the cabinet. I think, are there Muslims in the cabinet now? There's certain.
I think there is actually.
Yeah, I was just trying to. Yeah, I'm not sure there isn't. Yeah, because Sajid, people like Sajid Javid and things aren't anymore. But certainly, she has been in a party where, there have been these senior figures. Like, you don't have to like the current Conservative government or think they're any good at anything. But it seems to me this is a, this feels like a sort of celebrate, not celebrate, but this seems like a pretty good tick in the multiculturalism box. Like, this isn't just people of different races of ethnicities. It is genuinely people who come from different backgrounds with different sets of beliefs who are in one place, who are working together in one country. And like, I don't know. And also, like, what's her evidence on the other side of it? Like, there aren't, maybe I'm naive, but I don't see sort of failure of multiculturalism, sort of race riots in places. I don't see a kind of like, what is this? What is this line? What's she got? What's kind of, where's she, what's she going with here? What's the position? What's her? It baffles me. I mean, Sona Braverman generally baffles me because I find that someone with, that thankfully anyone with these views ends up in a senior position in this country is kind of, it's just like, it's both baffling and deeply concerning.
Well, it's really.
I'm,
Sorry, go, Simon.
no, I mostly, I'm just gabbling, I fear.
Thoughts, Luke?
I mean, what she said, like she said, well, doesn't make sense because you're comparing apples with cheese, with chalk, with fish, basically. There is no, I mean, what, like you say, what do you mean when you talk about multiculturalism? Because you're talking about four very different models of integrating immigrant population, if trying to integrate immigrant populations into society. So I think it's pretty meaningless. It's almost word salad, to be honest.
And so here's the thing. I think it's probably not worth dismissing it as word salad. Partially because she may end up as the next Tory leader, certainly if the leadership changes after the next election. But which I'm less convinced about now. I think there's I mean, there's three possibilities. One, it's just a dog whistle. People, when you say multiculturalism, people There's a version of multiculturalism that no Tory would support, where it's like, you're very, you're very deferential to community groups. You don't try and create a sense of common patriotism. You center voices that say we shouldn't be proud to be British, all this sort of stuff. And like obviously no Tory is going to support that. And so you say, no, that's multiculturalism. So that's an easy applause line. And if if the racists in the party hear it as something a bit more extreme, then if that makes you like them, so be it. I think there's, when we talk of multiculturalism, I think since the 70s, we've really meant multi-faithism. In the sense of, we are gonna kind of like be more accommodating of people from different faiths. And I wonder whether we're getting to the point where that approach has reached the end of the road, because actually we're now getting to a situation where it is religious people versus proactive liberals. So we are almost ending up into a slightly different version of the French style argument, where you have conservatives saying, we know religious people should be free to believe what we feel, which will be very tightly defined around the stuff that religious Christians are comfortable with, but they try and co-opt people from other faiths to be this popular front, in the same way that beforehand and Protestants tried to co-opt Catholics, beforehand Anglicans tried to come co-opt nonconformists. As like the quote unquote religious majority gets defeated, it broadens its boundaries to let in more people. What I really worry that this is a sign of is that the Tory party will become explicitly anti-Muslim. Because, yes, it makes no sense why a cabinet with Hindus or Buddhists would be against cultural diversity. It makes a lot more sense why a cabinet full of conservative Hindus and conservative Buddhists might be willing to go along with anti-Muslim policies. That's what I fear. That's what I fear. This is kind of the starting pistol. I don't think that's what most Hindus and Buddhists in this country want, because in the same way that the major Muslim organizations always kind of sided with Jewish organizations when they were complaining about Jeremy Corbyn's anti-Semitism, I think religious minorities in this country realize, no, we hang together or we hang separately. But I worry that this is the kind of dynamite that Braverman's starting to play with.
It feels very. There've been issue. We know. Sajid Javid in the 2019 Conservative Leadership Election. Sorry, I genuinely had to try and remember what year it was. There've been so many Conservative leadership elections in recent years. Did try and raise the fact that there are, so that the issues around Islamophobia in the Conservative Party. I mean, and it was. And obviously, it was used by people who were much more supportive of the Labour leadership at the time to basically dismiss the issues of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. But it doesn't mean there aren't issues around that, and that this isn't creating the mood music for a very
Oh no, well,
unpleasant.
we there was a report. The report said there were issues, and people who don't know what they're talking about didn't realize what that report was doing. That report was and like it was given that they've not done anything, it was accepted. The report that was ultimately made due to Javid's complaints was basically the Tory party saying, please don't shout at us, EHRC. We're doing it because they literally did the work. They did the action plan, so the Equality Human Rights Commission could say, okay, you're taking this in hand. You're doing it by yourself. So like, there absolutely was an issue with Islamophobia. Tory parties admitted it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really feel we're dancing on the precipice of quite a ugly turn in British politics, unless the Tory party can be defeated from having a second Asian leader in the row, which is a weird thing to say, but like I think the forces Braverman is flirting with are dangerous.
The question is whether she knows that it's like, does she know what she's doing almost? You know, and I don't know. I don't know enough about her politics in a weird way.
Her mother was a Conservative Party activist.
Yeah, okay.
So like, I like this is where I really would, I know you referenced it. Like, I would strongly push back on this is that she had, she's self-hating or she has cognitive dissonance, learned helplessness. No, she was brought up in a very right-wing family. And again, we always say, people should not treat Black, Asian, mixed, or other people as a homogenous whole. Well, sort of Braverman seems to be doing that to like not just a factor of five or a factor of 23, like the full when you break down the classifications. Because also, her family has maybe a different experience of diversity than other people, given that, I think her mother was from East Africa.
Yeah, is it her or Patel who have got a Uganda, come from the Ugandan Asian?
So I can't, I think her mum's from East Africa. I think her dad's from Mauritius, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
So I yeah, it's I think it is alarming, and I think it's one to watch. The one of the did anybody have anything to add on that? I
Nope.
did. I did think Sunak's response was very interesting. Because I think that's close as this came to slaps Braverman down. Because obviously, like Sunak himself, his wife, is Indian. Like he had to be quite clear about this last year when the non-dom stuff was coming out. Like she's Indian. No, she's not. She doesn't want to be British. She is Indian. She's very happy to live in Britain, but she's proud of being Indian, which, like go back to your point, Simon, is a multicultural family. And I always get the heebie-jeebies about this foreign mother stuff, percentage of children who have a foreign mother. And obviously, declared interest, both my children have a foreign mother. No, sorry, born overseas mother, because Bimbi's got naturalized citizenship. But I think the EBGBs are both because of, like, it's clearly, it's this intersectional EBGBs, if that makes any sense, in the sense of, I think it's clearly designed to make people think of black or Asian men fucking white women. Like, I really think that's well, no, it's very random because it's for a woman. But, like, I think it's trying to get people to think of stuff like that, because no one would say, no, Boris Johnson was born outside the UK. No one would think of his children as having a parent born, no, born outside the UK, a foreign born parent. No, if Martin ever has children, no one would think of his children of having a foreign born mother. You know, it is clearly a dog whistle to think of children whose mother or parents look differently to the three of us, to think of them as foreign. Right, it's like the most disgraceful dog whistle, particularly when it literally applies to the children of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
The other thing, I don't know if you guys saw this, is that you had people say, oh, you know, you may not like what some of a Braverman says, but where's your solution, Libs? And I couldn't help but think, where's hers?
It's not. Yeah, she's not like this is in both cases. It's not. She's. It is classic dog whistle because there's no solutions here.
Like, I don't, I like, I think this is where, like, the how bad the speech was is, I think, really illustrative, because unfortunately we're not going to have time to talk about Donald Trump because we're going really long, but, like, you know, Donald Trump, as chaotic as Donald Trump is, as riddled with veto points as the American system is, you know, he made Jeff Sessions his attorney general, which I think is the UK equivalent of Jeff Sessions is actually John Haynes in terms of immigration restrictionism. What do you think, Luke?
Who's John Haynes?
Say again.
Who's John Haynes?
No, I'm remembering the guy
Do you
right.
mean John Hayes, the guy that Suella
Hayes,
Braverman
Hayes,
got
Hayes.
sacked in
Sorry.
inverted commas for
Yeah,
sending?
I did an end. Yeah, John Hayes.
Okay.
You know, like a long-standing hard right immigration restrictionist. I think that's comparable. Obviously, it's not the executive experience Jeff Sessions has, but, like, I think in terms of being like one of the kind of lodestars of immigration restrictionism, John Hayes is a good stand-in for Jeff Sessions. So, like, do you agree?
More like Stephen Miller, really. But anyway, that's
No, because Stephen Miller wasn't a politician.
yeah, okay.
Because you remember, like, the reason Stephen Miller got into Trump's orbit is through.
Through Jeff Sessions, yeah, okay, fair enough.
And so, like, you know, Jeff Sessions had a couple of years as Attorney General, fell out of favor for other reasons. But he had smuggled Stephen Miller in, so Stephen Miller became very close to Donald Trump. And you know what? You know, they actually restricted immigration to America. Like, they ramped up enforcement. They closed legal avenues. Like, they weren't talking about it. They did it.
Did it, yeah.
Now, Suella Braverman has been, no, with a gap, she's been Home Secretary for just about a year. She'll probably be Home Secretary for another 50 months, 16 months.
Oh no, she's looking for a reason to resign.
You won't give her one.
No, it's
Oh yeah. Well,
about it'll be
we.
about if you stay till the election, she'll be Home Secretary for about another year.
The election's going to be in January, mate. You might as well resign yourself to it.
Anyway, what's your point, Will?
My point is, just do it. Why is John Hayes not getting her to do it? Why is it all about making her leader? Because, based on what's gone on for the past two changes of government, the Tories aren't going to get back in power for another 12 years. And you can actually go further. There's never been a Labour government that hasn't added votes second time round as it's gone to the country. Even the first Macdonald government added votes when it went back to the country. Even in 31, the Labour Prime Minister stayed as Prime Minister. This might be the last time the Tories get to be in charge of the Home Office. The last 2 years, we go back to this time last year. This no Braverman stint in the Home Office. In the last 2 years, the Tories get to be in charge of the Home Office until the mid 2030s. Why aren't they using it? No, like why? No, like you. No, Stephen Bush has made this point. You look at all the shit Howard managed to push through with a government with a far smaller majority than this now, when this stuff was much more controversial, because you had more moderate liberal Tory MPs. Why not push through stuff? Let alone the fact that the Home Secretary has great swathes of executive action that they can do without even going to Parliament. Like, why is she campaigning to be leader of the opposition? You can do fuck all as leader of the opposition. Why is she not doing it now? And why are immigration restrictionists not pushing her to do more now? It just talks about the fact that, the Tory party has just became this circus. It's became completely postmodern. Everybody's forgotten that the point of politics is to do stuff, to do things. Like, I'm not opposed to immigration restrictionism. I'm not opposed to doing stuff on the border. But I don't see anybody doing it. And you get idiots. Cunts, let's be honest. Cunts like Matthew Godwin saying, oh, liberals hate Willa Braverman, but where's their solution? Where's the fuck hers? Her things won't work. That's why, even people like myself, who are maybe a bit more authoritarian, are more than happy to side with Keir Starmer on these issues because he's right. This shit won't fly.
All right. Shall we wrap up?
So, yes. So, any final thoughts on that?
No, I think that you ended it very nicely there.
Well, thank you. Very briefly, I'm going to quickly do it and finally round robin. Very quickly. So, Simon, anything you would want to highlight not to do with politics?
Not to do with politics. Is there anything I'm trying to think now. No, I don't. No, I don't. Nothing comes to mind.
Let me come back to you as we go around. So, Luke, we know what you want to talk about.
Yeah, well, just very briefly, the Liverpool Spurs VAR contretemps. It's very, very funny because it's just obviously not offside. Obviously not an offside goal. But B, I
Such it
wanted.
happened to such a laid back club that
Yeah.
won't freak out that this stuff
Yeah.
happens to him.
D doesn't have a massive victim complex. I don't know what you guys think of the of Arsene Wenger's solution to this, because I think Arsene Wenger is right about this. The way you solve this problem is to reform the offside law, so it's not offside if any part of the player's anatomy is behind the line.
Yes,
Yeah.
like this is the point I keep making to you, isn't it? Like, we went through this with cricket when cameras came in, that the so with cricket the equivalent to offside was the kind of the angle the bowler's arm is as they release the ball, and they were the. It so unfortunately came out that a freak player, who like literally was like double jointed, they can do all sorts of weird things with his arm.
He was chucking it.
They literally had him bowl with a cast, Luke. He came along just as the video cameras were kind of coming to the modern age, and like so they had to like do like a serious investigation. And they showed that actually no one could meet the rule. Like it was when you actually look at it with a camera to that level of specificity, it was an impossible rule to meet. So they had to let a degree of flex. And like I personally I would go further. I've always thought the way it should work is that there should be a part of the pitch that once you get to that point, offside doesn't matter. So, like, you have it where, if you pass a ball from your own third, offside matters. If you pass a ball from the middle third, sorry, offside matters. Don't I'm getting a track. You divide it into thirds. So if you pass it from your own third, the middle third, offside matters. But if it's a pass within the opponent's third, offside doesn't matter. Because I think that would just the That will just get rid of most of these arguments. Like, offside is there to stop goal hanging, like to stop people just having the striker just like hang around the penalty box all the time. So as long as you say like they have to move with the play, what's the problem? Like, does anybody matter? Does anybody care if like the midfielder gets a brilliant crossing from 30 yards out and it hits the striker heads it in? What's like what are we trying to achieve with this rule?
Yeah.
But really, what you're saying then is that it's no longer about the offside rule. We need to go to the rule that was used in the noughties internet game Slime Soccer, which was one of those things that I wasted too many free periods in the sixth form playing, where it was just called pinged for goal hanging, and basically if you hung around the goal, you'd be banned. I've realised I do have some things because
Yes.
obviously in that. But, so, firstly, I want to rec just I just a little recommendation because he hasn't been mentioned, and I know that the ding bell is feeling sad. There was a really lovely little set of essays on Radio 3 on their show called literally called The Essay. They're quarter of an hour each, which is basically like people talking about little moments in pieces of culture that really matter to them. The best of them actually was the first one, which was broadcast, was talking about basically one moment in the film, in the delightful film You've Got Mail, which is just a lovely thing about the power of the redemptive power of art and the joy of being a fan of things. But Stephen Bush, ding,
Ding.
did a piece on the pieces of silence at the end of the third movement of Sibelius' Fifth Symphony, which inevitably was really, really good and was incredibly interesting and intelligent about a piece of music that I have now listened to, but I had not listened to when I read that. All of them are lovely. There's a lovely one about When the Tiger Came to Tea. They're all just delightful. They're that classic thing of a classic piece of how to do arts journalism properly, of like, it's all about what art can do to you, how it can, what it, thoughts and ideas that it can trigger within you. Really nice pieces of work. They're 15 minutes each. Classic commuting fodder. Highly recommend. So they're the ones that went out in the essay format basically all of last week. All of the, I haven't listened to the last one, but all of them, other than that, the others are all brilliant. That's the first one. Second one, again, I'm sorry, I'm being artsy. There was a poll or story this week which was, you know, greatest opening lines in the history of literature. And the first line of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone won, basically because now, wherever you sit on the trans rights debate, there are certain things that just become like, it all becomes tediously totemic and it's no longer about the art. Like, the Harry Potter novels were obviously massively important to the publishing industry, particularly the YA publishing industry. I don't think anyone would say their first lines are up there with, you know, it's a truth universally acknowledged that a man with a great fortune must be in want of a wife, or, you know, all families are all happy families are the same, all unhappy families are unhappy differently. You know, I think I've mangled both of those brilliantly, but like, it's this classic. It's the classic problem. It is a problem of just kind of. And it's happening most significantly in the kind of trans versus gender critical battle, but it sort of happened among, it happened when you had sort of Corbyn, of just like lots of people being unwilling to actually think that of not actually engaging with the question. It's all just sort of fandom. If the first thing I'm recommending is like the positivity of fandom and the positivity of taking joy in art, that's kind of the flip side, is like, instead of actually looking at something seriously, it's just voting for something to make some kind of esoteric point rather than actually taking these things seriously.
So I'm going to follow that up with make with recommending something to make an esoteric point. Sorry, I couldn't resist. But no, in all seriousness, I agree with that entirely, and it did inspire my pick, which is so again, I'm going to cheat. And Luke, if you want to make a second pick, we'll come back to you. If not, I'll make a pick on your behalf. So the two I have is, first of all, I think one of the things we really have an issue with, and my solution to it is more state funding, because of course it is the depth of cultural journalism. I think as things get more wedded to subscription models, to online advertising, you'll get this, you know, online cultural journalism, which is primarily where cultural journalism is now, because of the death of magazines, because of the decline of newspapers. It is about telling people that that thing they like is good, and that, you know, that's such a not just good, but it's really important, and they should base their identity around it. And so I would like to say, first of all, read actually Paul O'Brien. He's got a really interesting column on HowStuffDamaged.com about the Purple Man. So Paul O'Brien is probably doing the opposite of what I've just said, because he has dedicated, my God, it is approaching 30 years to reviewing every X-Men comic online. Like, literally, it's before this century when he started doing this. But he, no, he branches out on the, but like, unlike most completionists, he's a very intelligent, broad-based guy, a lot of interesting ideas. And he started a series after. You want to hear a Herculean task, Luke. You thought it was difficult navigating the evolution of British military tactics. He's had to chart every appearance of Wolverine in a comic.
Crikey.
Yeah. So he's now started looking at the introduction of villains in Daredevil comics. And this his latest one is about the Purple Man, who, for those who watch the Netflix Marvel series, the Purple Man was the bad guy in Jessica Jones, the first Jessica Jones series. But he was like, you know,
The one played by David Tennant.
yeah, the one played by David Tennant. But like he was back there at the creation. Like he was a full villain introduced in Daredevil back in the 60s. And it's a really interesting look at, you know, was it appropriate to turn this goofy 60s supervillain into an avatar of rape? And the answer he comes to is basically, yeah, kind of, because it was there, the creator just didn't realize. So, and I think it's a really good kind of exploration where people are thinking through, like, he is not dismissing the argument that this is inappropriate. He's thinking through, you know, okay, what do I think about this? Do they have a point? No, they don't have a point. I can tell them why. So I think it's a really well-judged piece. I've actually forgotten my second piece because I switched. Oh, yeah, I haven't my second piece, which unfortunately means I'm gonna have to mention a third piece because I'd switched midway. So the piece I was gonna recommend was actually Darren Mooney, who's a great writer for the escapistmagazine.com, who did one about Star Trek. He has been doing reviews about Star Trek Lower Decks. And Lower Decks has got into problems because it had somebody in Starfleet wearing a hijab. Obviously, because Star Trek had kind of hinted at a future where humanity had moved on from religion. And so my recommendation is actually reading Judge Anderson, The Jesus Syndrome. Because like Star Trek, Judge Dredd is based on the idea that humanity is now run by atheists. And so they actually have a story, which I think was published in like 1990, 1991, where a Christian revival is a dangerous religious movement that must be stamped out by the atheist government. And it's a really interesting exploration of the radical underpinnings of Christianity. I should really send it to you so you can forward it on to Rachel, actually, thinking about it, Simon. It probably sounds like it'd be a first read. But it's a very interesting kind of exploration about this thing that we think is the establishment. It's not the establishment for any intrinsic reason. It's just the establishment because that's the thing the people in charge believe in. Anyway, what do you think? What's your final pick, Luke?
Oh, my final pick. Seeing as you guys have gone for actually quite high culture, with your Sibelius, with your Sibelius.
Mine was a comic, so
Well, I don't know. You were talking about the nature of religion, so I'm gonna bring this conversation back down to earth. I've been really enjoying the new Michael Wolff book. And I feel kind of dirty for admitting that because, like, Michael Wolff has, on occasion, got into trouble for, shall we say, questionable sourcing of some of his other books. But he's obviously written the trilogy of books about the Trump presidency, Fire and Fury, probably being the most famous. And now he's written a book on the last 2 years of the Murdoch Empire, basically. And it's, I don't know, it basically that these books are smack for political nerds. I know it's not going to do me any good, and I know it's sort of gossipy and bitchy. It's like no, it's not smack for political nerds. It's like reading one of those magazines you can only pick up in supermarkets, but for political nerds, it's just this incredibly gossipy. It's just an incredibly gossipy book, but the central thesis of it is really interesting. And that is that Rupert Murdoch, this 92-year-old guy, is suspended between caring about his legacy, caring, how the world sees him and how his own family see him, and yet and realizing that Fox News is toxic, for his legacy, for his reputation. But just being unable, being almost physically unable to walk away from money, even though he has more of it than any of us would ever spend in a lifetime. The idea of burning down this network that is just a cash cow, that is just an excuse to print money, even though it's poisoning sort of almost every relationship he is a part of, he just can't do it. And like, there have been sort of question marks over, how Wolf knows some of the stuff that's in the book. And there are whole sections of it where you think there are only three possibilities here. Either he was sitting in the room taking notes, he has got verbatim notes off somebody else, or he's making it up. Because there are literally sections of it to have almost verbatim conversations. And like clearly he has interviewed Sean Hannity at length. Clearly he's interviewed Tucker Carlson at length. But like some of the conversations with Murdoch, like I can't believe he's interviewed Rupert Murdoch at length. So where is this coming from? But it's just like there is like a King Lear quality to it that is really compelling. Anyway, that was my last one.
I saw an interview with Michael Wolff where
Yeah.
the journalist was trying to entrap him to admit that he'd been on the plane at a key moment. And Michael Wolff, I think, almost accidentally let slip. And he was like, "Well, I'm not telling you I was on the plane. Maybe I was on the plane, maybe I wasn't." And of course, Murdoch stepped down literally the
Yeah.
week this book came out, which
Yeah. It's an absolute page turner of a book. I got it on Friday and finished it this weekend. That is how much of a page turner of a book it is. But it's just like, this is gossipy, this is bitchy, this is actually, there is a prologue where he goes back, yeah, we all know about secession, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, but this really is succession. And there's this whole bit in the beginning where he talks about like how Murdoch is constantly explaining, like constantly saying he's not Logan Roy, he's not Logan Roy, he's not Logan Roy. It's like, you are kind of Logan Roy, Rupert, you really are.
I don't know if it mentions it, but I know I read in Vanity Fair that when he divorced Jerry Hall, one of the things it put in that in her like postnup was you can't talk to the producers of Succession.
Okay.
Like this is a thing. Like this is, I think it's true of everything. Like nothing matters. But the rich and powerful are much more vain than you think, and they're much more sensitive. Because, like, I remember years ago when I worked for student in a student's union, I would roll my eyes at the student activists who do their die-ins and their protests and all the kind of cliche activism shit. And Then I saw how scared when one of the people doing that actually ran for education. I saw how scared the people above me were, and how for the first time they demanded to know the results. And then I happened to work at a different university in the university for somebody who'd been at that, who had been like in a senior role at the university at that same time. And he remembered this student activist. So, like, you would think what does succession matter to somebody as rich and powerful as Rupert Murdoch? But that kind of level-headedness, that ability to kind of see things in perspective,
Yeah.
that's why we're poor. You know, it's the mania to care when you've actually won that keeps people driving forward.
Yeah, but it's just like this whole thing about Fox News is destroying, destroying all, basically, it's toxic to all his relationships. And it's toxic to his idea of his legacy. But he just cannot leave money on the table. He can't do it.
Any final thoughts, Simon?
No, I don't think so.
Cool. Well, you have been listening to It Can Be Said, and we'll talk to you again in a while.